Welcome to Novo Ed Talks, where we reveal real-world strategies and expert insights from learning and development professionals. In every episode, we chat with practitioners, course designers, learning strategists, and business leads. We hear about their experiences in the learning industry and predictions for the profession and the trends that they're seeing. But before we get started, a little bit about Novo Ed. Founded at Stanford's Social Algorithms Lab in 2012, Novo Ed is a people-centric, capability-building platform that combines social and collaborative learning to drive performance readiness at scale. Through cohort-based experiences centered around human interaction, Novo Ed taps into collective wisdom, placing each learner at the center of perspective, application, and expertise. Large enterprises such as 3M, GE, Marriott International, and Nestle partner with Novo Ed to accelerate their critical initiatives, reconnect teams, and achieve rapid alignment through learning that is felt, experienced, and swiftly transformed into impact. Now, let's meet our guest for today's episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Novo Ed Talks podcast, a space for training trailblazers to get real. My name is Melissa Fisk. I am the producer of the Novo Ed Talks podcast, and today we have a very special episode for you. In fact, today's episode is the final of the two episodes we are doing as a season one finale of Novo Ed Talks. So if you haven't listened to that first episode, we highly recommend you go back and do that now. We've got a lot of more great discussions to have when it comes to AI and L&D today, so we're going to jump right back into our conversation in just a second here. But just as a quick reminder, if you're listening to part two at a later date and time, in this episode, we'll again be hearing sound bites from some of our Novo Ed Talks guests throughout season one, and then going a little bit deeper with our roundtable discussion guests. Our guests include Judy Albers, Director of Research Enablement at the Institute of Corporate Productivity at I4CP, Kara Halter, Senior Director of Global Learning Innovation at GP Strategies, and Matt Donovan, Chief Learning and Innovation Officer at GP Strategies. So without further ado, let's jump back into our next core theme. Next theme, which has to do with like balancing the technology with human-centric approaches. So let's really quickly hear from some of our Novo Ed Talks guests throughout the season. First up, we'll hear from Anders Forsberg, the head of Navistar University at Navistar.
And the access to technology, the access to generative AI is so big now, everyone has it. So to find information and knowledge is not going to be an issue, really. There are so many tools that can do that. So in my head, we have to figure out how do we not lean on the technology, maybe on the technological platforms, but how do we work to strengthen the human sides that AI so far maybe cannot answer up to, like how do you build on your experience to take the right decisions? What is wisdom essentially, and how can we help on that side? Because I think that's the side where we can add more value in the future.
And here's Heather Balsarek, the Senior Manager of Corporate Learning and Development at Maximus.
When we take that kind of being intentional, right, not overthinking it, we got to take that into something like AI. You have to be intentional with it. You can't just throw something in there and, yep, that's the first thing I'm going to use that. No, it's your brainstorm. It's your sounding board. It's your, I can't think of anything right now, help me start tool.
Yeah.
And then be intentional with the prompts and be intentional with what you're looking for out of it. And then that's going to help you do whatever you're doing. So, I mean, that's the future of L&D, I think, is going to obviously include a lot of AI assistance, a lot of automation of things. But I think the future of L&D is also more human-centered.
All right, Judy, Kara, and Matt, let's dive a little bit deeper. How can AI enhance rather than overshadow human aspects of learning, and what's our ethical responsibility as L&D leaders there?
Yeah, I'll just throw out one of the conversations that we've been having. So I don't think this is a settled decision, but it's an example of a conversation we've had. And so one of the things we do is we look at What are some of the challenges organizations are trying to do? And coaching has probably been forever one of the biggest challenges. How do we scale coaching? How do we get good coaching out there? We know it's very human and manual centric, and it requires wisdom of humans to get there. And there's kind of two camps on how people are trying to solve this problem. There are purveyors of platforms who are saying, I'm going to give you an all AI coach on one side, so I can actually really scale on demand 24/7, probably in your own language. We're going to try and build this rubric that the AI coach can do it. So it's you're supplanting the human with AI. The other camp is really looking at how do I take the value of a coach and extend the reach of my coaches and think of my team now as a coaching team as human plus AI to be able to extend and be able to do that. So I may have a primary connection with them, but then my additional coaching bots are able to do the checking up and the nudging and the follow-up or find a resource. So we rethink what is the work that a coach does, and we look to extend. So we have two ways we're doing it. One is that efficiency and care. You talked a little bit about that. How can we do it faster and cheaper? Or the other side is really coming back and saying, how do we really dig in and take the very essence of the humans, the most our most precious element, the platinum of the conversations that we have, and that's the real human to human time, use that where we need it, but then augment this with additional coaching resources in those bots, a range of folks to now extend your reach from a coach of doing 1 to 5 to 1 to 50 and being able to do that. So I want to throw that out there and here. I mean, Carrie, we've done a little bit of Judy, we've talked about that. I just want to get your thoughts on as well as like that kind of what's the ethical and the challenges in both of those.
Yeah, it's interesting. We are at GP, we are creating a course right now on leadership and AI, how those two things play together. And one of the topics that we're actually trying to tackle in that course is coaching. And we've gotten into some really good conversations about it in turn because I think, and this actually seems to be a theme in almost any topic that comes up about AI. There's always like two sides to the same coin when you talk about AI of like, well, it could be this or that. And I think from a coaching perspective, some of those two sides that we've been talking about is AI as a tool for coaches. So like in elevating the skills of leaders today who are responsible primarily today for doing the coaching, how can AI help those coaches get better at what they're doing? How can it support them to ask better questions or to brainstorm how to deal with conflict amongst their employees or to get advice on how to approach a situation? Like they're sort of like a coach of a coach almost there. But then there's also like, how do you start to use AI as a coach to the employees themselves, where it's almost that the conversations we've been having all along of enhance the human or replace the human, right? So there's that side of the coin too of how do we use these AI tools to really just better provide performance support or to provide tools along the way that would typically have required a human. Yeah, and there's just so many possibilities there. Like there's just so many different ways to think about it, and so many creative options around what that can mean. That yeah, I think it's a really exciting space for AI.
As another recovering instructional designer, like Matt,
We're in good company here.
yes, I think you're right. You're right on when you talk about a range of bots. If we look at the science of behavior change, and I don't think that in corporate learning, we have been disciplined enough, at least not in the US. I honestly think our European counterparts are far more disciplined than we are about understanding the science of our profession. But if you look at the science of behavior change, you can build a range of AI assistants that can do things like nudge you to practice. We know that learning has to take place spaced out. An AI assistant can let you practice in a safe way. In fact, there is data showing that people would rather be coached by an AI coach than a human coach because they don't care what they say. Like they can say the problematic thing that they wouldn't even dare, the AI is not going to judge you. And so they probably wouldn't dare say the problematic thing that they really want to say to a human coach, but they would say it to a bot. The same thing goes with patients who, when given the chance to speak to their doctor or a highly trained bot, chose overwhelmingly chose the bot. In fact, they said that the 10 times more people viewed the bot as more empathetic and patient than their own doctor.
Yeah. Fascinating.
And, well, let me think of it. I can ask, like, my doctor doesn't have time to answer all my questions, but I can ask all of the questions of a bot. So of course they're going to be empathetic and patient. And so those are the ways in which if we as learning designers are thinking about, okay, A, it's our job to develop a range of bots that help people learn according to what we know about cognitive science and behavioral change. But then B, when we make the bots, especially if it's a bot that helps you do the task, if we can also program these AI assistants to teach you how to think instead of just do the task for you, you can do that. And because I've found that in making my own GPTs, yeah, first I automated the process, but then I realized I'm not going to get organizational change unless people understand the nuances. So now my bot, before it does the job for you, the bot prompts you. And so it teaches you what you need to know about the ethics of a situation, about the judgment calls that you should make, the sort of professional skepticism that's been very difficult for companies to teach people who just kind of follow a checklist to get work done.
But I think it's taking that, but we need to get to the other side where the bots bring us to the humans, not separate and go, I'd rather deal with a bot than a human. Mm. I mean, the problematic thing that I see about the data on the doctors versus the bot is that this is a problem we have with doctors. No, they didn't do it against nurses because nurses are awfully generally the ones that are there to emotionally connect with the patients after the physicians left the room, unfortunately. But, you know, that's where I get most of what I need from them. But I think that's the thing, is we need to bring an inclusive mindset. That's the ethics around this, is that if we use the bots to isolate, and this is the problem, if I get too much reliance by myself, I don't connect with others. And when it gets to new productivity and I need to collaborate and work with others, and we create the behaviors where we can't collaborate, we can't communicate, we can't connect, we've built transactional bots because they're easy to build. The ethical challenge is we don't do the easy, we do what's right, and we build a bot that brings us together, not the transactional serve it up, let you be isolated. And that's the problem as an L&D practitioner, is that, well, we can kind of do this. Well, we'll do this in a stage. The problem is that your first stage creates all the damage that you will not be able to resolve because you've created a system which disables you to address the future problems that we have.
I mean, kind of like social media in 1999.
Social media. And I mean, I think, you know,
how many different ways can this go wrong? And can we get in front of that as much as we can now?
Right. You know, I had an opportunity to interview a guy named Matt Bean. He's a professor at UC Santa Cruz, and he wrote a book called The Skill Code. And Matt was studying the introduction of robotics into workforces long before generative AI. He was studying robotic surgery. He was studying drones in the military. And so he was talking to people at work. And what he found was that AI, the experts loved it. AI was assisting them. But then the junior surgeons or the junior soldiers, they weren't learning as much. So there's to Matt's point, you, Matt Donovan, but also Matt Bean, there is a risk to the future of human skill development if we don't make AI assistance in a way that actually develops people's skill. And Matt Bean talks about for him, the skill code, it's challenge, complexity, and connection. And so anyway, I highly recommend the book, or I highly recommend reading my 5-minute article on the interview. There's so much that we need to talk about regarding ethics. And there's one aspect of ethics that I think if we don't cover it, it'll be a miss on our part. And that is bias in AI. If you don't know this already as a learning professional, the quick answer is that large language models, having been trained on the internet, are also trained on all of the bias in the way words are put together. And so AI will come back to you with the most probable next word or next pixel in the image. And what that means is that if you say, give me an image of a superhero who is a man, the man's costume will cover his whole body and the woman's costume will not. The woman's costume will, and the woman's body will be highly sexualized. And you apply that to every stereotype, every group that has been disenfranchised and oppressed. And the AI doesn't have the nuance to know, oh no, that's not actually reality. That is, you know, what the oppressor has painted the oppressed as. So the responsibility that we have to do bias audits of our AI tools, bias audits of our algorithms, you can't assume that even if you bought the tool from a vendor, you cannot assume that they've done a good enough job. You have to try out, you have to ask it the hardest questions and see if you can find ways in which AI is delivering you biased answers.
And I think that that's, you know, when we're working with vendors, because we do a lot in the Innovation Kitchen about emerging vendors. I mean, the question that I'm asking is, what are you doing to reduce bias? And they go, well, we use a large language model and they've got things. And I said, no, what are you doing in the way in which you're bringing the workflow to this table? And then using our data with our contributions, what's the mechanism in place to address it? Because it's not just one thing that I created it, but you're actually reinforcing the training of the bot by the fact that you don't challenge. So bias
should
be a natural part of the design and development process. Bias challenge should be, you know, maybe we should, you know, call Walt Dick and say, hey, maybe we should do Addy, and bias becomes a step in the design phase where we have to be at the bottom, challenge bias in our data sets. But that's, we have to do that, because that's the thing with large data sets is, you, once they kind of cemented and trained, they are slow to evolve over time, unpredictably. And you can influence them at scale, but you can also influence them by what you do. And this is where I think, as L&D professionals, we need to get a deep understanding of data, data structuring, data impact, the way bias falls into it, data visualization. We need to hurry up and figure this out, because if we don't, we're just going to be passing along the problems without actually fixing them.
Garbage in, garbage out, right? That's been a problem for forever in data.
I'll provide, Melissa, for our listeners, some examples of suppliers in the L&D space who actually have a really solid approach to managing bias in their platforms, because I think you need to talk to your own vendors and go, listen, if you just answer me like, oh, that's a black box, or that's, you know, outside of my area of expertise, shame on you. Your AI should be explainable. It should be transparent. And I want to be able to say, well, your competitor explains it this way. And if you can't do it, it tells me that you're not protecting against bias.
Yeah, absolutely. So important. And I love that comment you made, Matt, about like in any kind of like process, adding maybe that in as a like last step, challenge bias, right? Like just like putting that in there.
And as we start to use AI to help us generate, I mean, I can think of all the platforms that go, ooh, I got an AI builder. The thing is, what's the data you're pulling from? What's your bias filter as you're putting this in place? And how are you going to address it? And I think that's one of the bigger challenges that we need to, that should become like a second nature to us, not like this really hard thing to think out. And I go, I have no role in this.
I think there's a Matt Donovan's guiding principles for any learning professional using an AI assistant to do our jobs.
I've always been a big fan of Leroy Jethro Gibbs and NCIS, his list of like 78 rules. I've always been a fan, you know.
78 rules?
He's got 78 rules out there.
No.
I'm a big fan.
Give me five.
Five rules? I can only give you five? Okay. All right. Yes.
A slight shift in direction, but I think this, where my brain is going to right now too, is this goes back to the whole, what are we teaching the bots versus what are we teaching the humans? And we as L&D professionals, what are the skills that we need to be focused on teaching people? And we've got some interesting, like, ideas floating around in GP right now. And one of them is this idea of intelligence. And so for a long time now, there's, you know, there's standard IQ, right? How smart are you? What skills do you have? What knowledge do you have? Like, how can you problem solve whatever? There's standard IQ. Then there's the EQ concept, you know, your emotional intelligence, which we've talked about, right? Like, how good is a bot really at empathy? Maybe that's debatable, but that's truly a human skill, right? Is having that emotional intelligence. Well, we've been talking about adding a couple more versions of intelligence to that mix so that there's also technical intelligence. So, you know, your ability to embrace these new technologies, to understand data, to make decisions with data, like, you know, how does that sort of play in? And then the really new one, which is where I was going with this whole conversation, is cultural intelligence. And I think that's a really important new factor in, you know, what truly makes humans humans and how you really excel at what you do. And that side, like, so AI can definitely help supplement and possibly replace the IQ and like the TQ, the technical stuff, right? But can it really replace our EQ or our CQ, right? Our cultural intelligence. And it's going to be a long time, I think, before it really can understand cultural awareness and understand why this person is going to be sensitive about X, but not Y, or understanding differences in just human nature and human behavior and human experience. It just can't do that. So how do we continue to focus on those skills and teaching people how to get better at doing that, and get better at evaluating what's coming out of AI in that it is not doing that. So I think there's a lot of room for growth there and where L&D can go next.
Absolutely. And you could tie that back into the personalization aspect too, right? The cultural that where it's like, if you're creating like a global learning and development program for your company, but it's in different regions of the world, it's like, are you taking into account those different like cultural changes throughout? Kind of moving on to the next topic, this is going to tie into this, but our fourth core theme has to do with utilizing AI for innovation and future readiness. So a lot of the concepts that we've been talking about, like how do we kind of prepare for that? Here are some sound bites from our Novo Ed Talks guests throughout the season. First up, we have Oscar Molina, a training manager at LHH Recruitment Solutions.
Some of the rapid development that I've seen, obviously, has been more on the AI front, right? How can we utilize that technology to further enhance our trainings? How can we use that technology to equip our colleagues to make deals faster? And in reality, there's so much more to work out right there in the AI front. It's really interesting to see the ways that we can integrate it. I mean, I can draft a recruiting email today and I can say, you know what? I want to make it sound like Taylor Swift wrote this recruiting email. I want to make it seem like she wrote it based on Red, her album. And ways that we can incorporate that to reach colleagues that might sympathize with Taylor Swift and that in that album is fantastic.
And now we'll hear from Abby Pinto, Director of Talent Development at Thomson Reuters.
We've identified and are in the process of identifying a few critical skill areas that we believe are really essential for all our employees. So I put AI in that bucket for sure. And that means how do I, in my role, use the tools at my disposal effectively to transform my work and improve my work.
And now a quick clip from Lisa Ellis, head of product at Sandler Systems.
One of the things that I'm excited about, we haven't released it yet, but we're starting to work on it, is AI role play. And so this is real-time AI role play, but instead of chatting, so typing, it would be talking to an avatar. There are a couple of platforms out there that are doing it today, but there's another subscription you have to buy, another, you know, API you have to set up. We're actually partnering with an e-learning development firm who has a game plan. We haven't fully launched it yet, but the idea would be that this actually gets written as a score package and deploys inside our learning management system along with all of our other content. And because it's SCORM, it works with our headless content engine and writes all the data on scoring and everything back to our learning management system.
Also from Sandler, a senior director, Ryan Riley.
I think no matter what, AI is never going to replace sales professionals, but sales professionals who use AI will replace those who don't. Yeah. So I think being an early adopter is something that is key. Understanding what's in front of you first. Sandler would always say that the first step to improvement is awareness. So being aware of all of these, you can't kind of, there's no longer the opportunity to say, well, I do it this way or I do it old school. You almost need to be on the forefront of it, especially as an educational and learning and development company. We need to make sure that we're staying ahead of the curve. You may not adopt it. You may decide that it's not good for you or good for your clients, but being aware of it so that when it does come up, I think is key.
Right, Judy, Kara, and Matt, let's dive a little bit deeper. What should learning leaders be doing right now to make sure their departments are future ready for AI?
L&D leaders, as well as the other leaders, innovation is a capability. Innovation is not a shiny object. It is not the things we put out. We often talk about, describe innovation to me, and they don't talk about a capability or a process. They talk about, ooh, an iPhone, or the invention of sliced bread. They talk about it on outputs, but actually what L&D leaders need to be able to do is to drive innovation as an integral capability of what we're doing. And that has to be part of it, to be a proactive approach to bring it in, whether it's evolutionary or revolutionary for what we do. It has to be sustainable. It has to be systemic. You have to think beyond just where you're at, and it has to be systematic, repeatable in the results. But that capability is what they have to do. And the one point in time I go back to is March of 2020. Pandemic hits, we all isolate, we all go our different ways. And what I was seeing anecdotally in my own personal experience, there were kind of two camps. L&D organizations that actually started with the concept of innovation using an evidence-based process, going back to seventh grade experimentation. We try something, we gather data, we try something else, we work our hypothesis, we learn things, and that's it. So those that actually had a working program were better able to respond to the disruption than those that didn't. Oh, now we've got to go out, we got to figure out how to bring Zoom in and start doing a bunch of classes in Zoom. And we haven't been thinking about this. We don't know about the cultural impact. We don't know. We have people that are Zoom bombing and we have data sitting in China. There were other organizations that actually proactively had started to think about what if we need to do this differently. And when the pandemic hit, you saw groups. So if you think about it, that, in 30 days, our answer used to be, well, tell me what the change is, and then give me 12 weeks, 3 months, and I'll get you a solution out there. That's 30, 60, 90 days. That puts you out of competition with somebody else. As the L&D, to get the workforce transformation where it needs to do, we need to have innovation as a core way to be able to predictably, proactively move an organization in ways that are going to be done. And that's why innovation has to be a capability, not a shiny object factory. That's not what it is. And revolutionary is wonderful, but evolutionary is just as important to everything we do. So anyway, I'm passionate about it. I'm studying it, but that's not enough. L&D integrates and says, well, innovation isn't what we do. Actually, it has to be a core component of what you're doing and driving it into the rest of the, and be those leaders for the rest of the organizations is bringing that to bear. So anyway,
I think some of this goes back to what we talked about in one of the previous questions, where, we have to think about what is an L&D department responsible for creating. Are we really the group who is now responsible for creating additional, e-learning courses and learning assets? Is that really what we're doing? Or to your point, Judy, are we really partnering with the development of technology and the tools that those technologies use to provide the data to support those tools, or to teach people how to use the tools, or to teach people how to think and ask good questions that, that make those tools more useful? Is our role shifting to be more about that than about just generating more courses or more traditional learning deliverables?
You know what this reminds me of? The last webinar that the three of us did together was about what skill sets do we think you need to hire for the modern learning professional? What are the skills that you should be hiring for and that we really haven't hired for today? And some of the things that we talked about in that webinar were that there are skills that IT professionals have. There are skills that user experience professionals have, that marketers have, that we haven't traditionally brought in to the learning and development space, but we need to. And what I see in the most progressive HR organizations, and I'm being part of an HR research firm now, the most progressive folks are talking about completely transforming HR, not just L&D, but all of HR. And many of them are using the phrase product-centric. Now that's, or agile, both of which are terms that come from IT. Yet another reason for you to be best friends with IT. But a product-centric organization brings in the tools and skills of product managers in software companies. What does a product manager do? They understand their audience. A lot of what an instructional designer does, they understand their audience, but they're constantly iterating. They're making prototypes, they're doing user testing, they're doing usability studies, they're iterating quickly. And so when I hear product-centric HR or agile HR, I hear people trying to structure the work so that innovation happens, to your point, Matt. And there are entire professions that have done this, and yet somehow in L&D and HR, we haven't been exposed to those professions. Like we don't study those professions and realize that there are plenty of proven practices and best practices that research supports. And you know, the other thing that I see happening, Kara, to your point earlier, is that instead of thinking about ourselves as HR functions, we think about the user journey of the employee life cycle. So I sometimes think that if I was going to go back to school now, I wouldn't study instructional design. I would study employee experience. I don't even know if you can get a master's in employee experience, but you should be able to. Because employee experience is like, here's the entire life cycle. We're attracting people. We're interviewing them, we're onboarding them, we're developing them, we're retaining them, we're promoting them, we're transferring, there's all these moments in the life cycle, and it's our job to support those moments, not to be the learning and development department. Like that's just so focused on us. If you're truly product-centric and user-centric, all you care about is the employee life cycle. And that means we're working together with IT and in partnership.
You brought up superheroes earlier. In closing, what do you think that learning professionals have as a superpower, and what is our kryptonite? If each of you could answer that.
Well, I think from my perspective, as I kind of look at the L&D professionals now, what we're facing, I think back to, probably 20, 25 years ago when we looked at supply chain management. And at the time, when you look at companies like Amazon and Walmart were coming out with thinking of new ways to do it. And then you had stores like Kmart and Sears, which were a little slower to adopt. But if you think about it at the time, supply chain management was about the location of warehouses, was about the price of gas, unions, all those kind of things. It was a what I would consider a cost center in the organization. And then when Amazon and Walmart kind of came to the table, it wasn't just about a cost containment. It actually became a competitive advantage for the organization because now they could look at data trends. So much more than saying, I sold a thing of toothpaste, put it on the truck, the next day it goes. We're starting to identify new revenue opportunities, new buying trends with what we have. The data and the insights became a competitive advantage that differentiated them from Kmart and Sears and set it out very differently. And I think from an L&D perspective, when it gets to our superpowers, we actually have that unique opportunity to get bit by the proverbial spider, become Spider-Man, or the gamma radiation. We have a choice. And I think data is going to be one of those things, is to lean in and understand how data is a force multiplier to drive the outcomes that we want to be able to have on the end user experience, the end user productivity, all of that we need to be able to do. And that means that we really need to understand, how do we do that? Whether it's the data structuring, the data engagement, the data visualization, these are things we need to be able to better understand so that we can actually get the insights, reapply them, create those truly personalized experiences, create more robust ecosystems of learning pathways, all that kind of stuff. I think this is going to be one of our opportunities. If we don't, it'll be handled elsewhere. And we, you know, question of which one are you going to be? Are you going to be Walmart? Or are you going to be Kmart? And I think that's, for me, sets up how we think about it.
Matt, thank you so much. Appreciate all your responses today in this episode. And I'm sure our listeners will too. Judy, Kara, either one of you want to take a stab at answering the superpowers question?
I'll piggyback on what Matt said, because I think I agree. Data, the lack of data literacy is our kryptonite. Interestingly, data literacy is not that hard to develop. In fact, there's a book on digital literacy, and I'll provide it. But the authors say that for digital literacy, you don't need to understand 100% of a technology, of a body of technical knowledge. 20%. If you understand 20%, you are digitally literate. So the bar isn't that high for us to get digitally literate, and yet. Yeah, if we don't, we're going to become obsolete. People are going to be making decisions about the value of our jobs in rooms that we aren't in. And the way to get in that room, I think, is to use our superpower. For me, our superpower, especially instructional designers, you are the sense makers. You've always been able to take a very complex body of knowledge and determine, what do people need to know in what order? You know, just the fact that we, you know how to give instructions, that's what you do to AI. And I find in my own work that I can prompt AI better because I'm an instructional designer and I just intuitively know how to ask it for what I need and how to, if I don't get what I need, I ask it a different way. And then I ask it a different way and a different way. And so that sort of sense that you've developed, you know, during the course of your career, trying to take somebody else's body of knowledge and communicate it in a way that makes sense that others can grasp, that gives you a superpower in helping your company develop AI assistance that nobody else has.
Yeah, I love that, Judy. Kara, we'll turn it over to you to kind of close out today's episode.
Yeah, and you know what, Matt and Judy just said so many things that I'm not even going to try to replicate those words. So I'll keep mine short. I think going back to a lot of things that we've been talking about for the last hour or so, I think just to recap that, I think truly our superpower is in understanding the human experience and being able to make those human connections and not forgetting that, you know, we are a crucial part of the human aspect of our organizations. And I think that really is our superpower. We need to grab a hold of that and keep a hold of that to say, yes, well, let's keep reminding them that this is about humans plus AI. This is about how do we keep teaching those human skills. And then the flip side of that is, I think our kryptonite sometimes is that, as Matt was almost saying, we are not always the most innovative part of a company. And we have a tendency to just keep doing what we've always done. And I think this is going to be a real opportunity for L&D departments to step outside of that and really think differently about what our responsibilities are and what the deliverables are that we need to provide to our organizations.
Absolutely. Kara, Matt, Judy, thank you so much. What a powerful season finale. Those episodes were jam-packed full of incredible, useful tips for all of our L&D listeners to kind of take and think about and apply to AI and L&D in their organizations and beyond. And a huge thank you to all of our season one listeners. This NovoEd Talks podcast would not be possible without all of you. So we thank you for your time and your enthusiasm in the podcast. And we hope that you'll tune in again for season 2.